Richard is current deputy director at the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago in New Zealand. He worked before that at Aberystwyth University and at the University of Manchester as well, holding different roles in the UK. I'm really, really pleased that Richard is able to come and speak with us today. I think it's not an exaggeration at all that he's been at the forefront of broadly critical research into terrorism and security for a long time now. He's got a prolific and, I think, an enviable publication record that includes 8 books and over 50 articles and chapters. From my own point of view, I first became aware of Richard's work when he wrote a book back in 2005, which was titled Writing the War on Terrorism. And that book, I think, was really important because it gave us the first sustained excavation of the political discourse surrounding the George W. Bush administration's war on terror. In my view, it's still the most comprehensive, the most penetrating engagement with that particular security paradigm, its construction and its consequences. More recently, Richard's been similarly pioneering, I think, in his work on topics including state terrorism, public perceptions of terrorism, and as well in trying to get us to think more carefully about the theoretical and the normative commitments that surround studying topics like terrorism critically. He's also the editor-in-chief and founding editor of the journal Critical Studies on Terrorism and the former convener of the BISA working group of the same name. Somehow, on top of all of that, he's recently found time to write a novel, Confessions of a Terrorist, which I have got here, and you would have access to if things were working better. Confessions of a Terrorist, I think, is a thriller. It's centred on a counter-terrorism interrogation between a British intelligence officer and a wanted terrorist. I think Richard's going to be talking to us today about the novel, and I recommend it very, very highly. It was my holiday reading this year, and it was excellent. So Richard's lecture is titled Terrorism, Taboo and Discursive Resistance, The Agonistic Potential of the Terrorist Novel. He's going to speak for around about 40, 50 minutes, something like that, and then he's happy to take questions and discussions afterwards. So if you wouldn't mind, please join me in welcoming Richard to the University of Otago.
Thanks, Lee, for that very kind introduction, and thanks for having me over. I'm very happy to visit here again and tell you about my novel. I'm sorry, I will sit just because I've got an injury in my knee and it's a bit painful to stand. But apart from shamelessly promoting my novel, the reason I'm doing this paper is I wanted to reflect on why I chose to write a novel in the first place, and this novel in particular, and then also as a way of reflecting on how I think narrative, as a mode of writing and analysis and pedagogy and so on, can act as a form of resistance at a number of different levels to the things that we've seen occurring in more than a decade of the global war on terror. And this has been a period in which we've seen not just, you know, vast levels of direct and structural violence in the name of counterterrorism, but also the kind of normalization and materialization of a terrorism discourse, or what anthropologists call the mythography of terrorism. Or we might even call it a truth regime, the terrorism truth regime, which has become, I think, a kind of a social structure, and at the very least, it's a kind of a cultural taboo that exists at many levels in our society. And so it's within that context, the political context, as well as an academic context in which we're seeing what many people are talking about as a narrative turn that's underway in IR itself, that this paper explores some of the ways in which the terrorist novel, as a specific site and mode of contemporary cultural discourse, might act both as a form of discursive resistance or literary resistance to the oppression and domination of contemporary counterterrorism, and as a site for emancipatory agonistic politics. Among an array of possible forms of aesthetically oriented discursive resistance, including things like poetry, music, and art, I want to contend that the novel has genuine potential due to its narrative storied form and potential societal reach. However, I have to say, to date, my view is that the terrorist novel has failed to reach its potential as a form of discursive resistance, but has instead tended to reinforce the counter-terrorist truth regime by reinforcing and maintaining the current terrorist mythography. Just to give you a little bit of background, at least in IR, there seems to be not much doubt that there is a growing narrative turn taking place, and that it has some kind of transformative potential for the discipline. It started to generate important debates, I think, about the limits of language, the ethics of storytelling, the inherent violences of representation, the importance of stories to resistance, the role of power in constructing narratives, the analytic value of ethnographic and autoethnographic approaches, the boundaries and practices of IR as an academic discipline, and the personal and professional risks and opportunities of adopting alternative research approaches, amongst other things. So, for example, the publication of Elizabeth Dauphine's novel, The Politics of Exile, as part of an academic series by an academic press, exemplifies this emerging trend. Described as an academic text written as a novel, Dauphine's novel and the special issue of Security Dialogue that was devoted to it, I think, is something of a landmark in IR for the way in which it transgresses the boundaries between fiction and social sciences, and extends the tools of critical IR theorizing. In fact, I think there is actually a broader recognition of the value of narrative as a kind of versatile and productive critical approach within social science and beyond. This is what I refer to as narrative as analytic, in the sense that narrative analysis is now widely employed as a research methodology within the field. And there's a great deal of work that examines, for example, the way in which elites construct public stories about events in order to justify policies such as going to war, how collective narratives and historical memory work to reinforce various normative orders, how stories govern and discipline certain kinds of bodies and subjects, and so on. More related to this, I think it can also be argued that narrative is also being employed directly as a kind of research methodology in and of itself, to the study of political and social life. This is, as Roland Bleicher suggests, because, and I quote, "aesthetic sources can offer us alternative insights into international relations, a type of reflective understanding that emerges not from systematically applying the technical skills of analysis which prevail in the social sciences, but from cultivating a more open-ended level of sensibility about the political. We might then be able to appreciate what we otherwise cannot even see, perspectives and people excluded from prevailing purviews, for instance, or the emotional nature and consequences of political events. Aesthetics, in this sense, is about the ability to step back, reflect, and see political conflict and dilemmas in new ways." In addition, I mean, I think that the narrative form allows for the exploration of theoretical concepts and ideas in the lived human condition and the human implications they entail in ways that professional academic writing is often not able to do. Oded Lowenheim explores conceptual categories such as security, war, terrorism, borders, refugees, and others in his autoethnographic narrative about mountain biking in the hills of Jerusalem. He argues that scholars should make an effort to humanize our writing because, and I quote, "when we refuse to write or read or teach and learn about the personal effect on us or on other people as specific individuals of the violence inherent in the political, we not only reify this violence as a given phenomena that takes place on the remote and abstract international level or in the barbaric context of civil strife, for example. What we do by such an evasion or refusal is to avoid more comprehensive discussion of the different facets and workings of violence and conflict." I think because narrative therefore attempts to be effective rather than confrontational and argumentative, which is the prescribed academic form, there is a greater chance that it will stick in the mind of the reader and perhaps have a more lasting effect. In this paper, I actually go on as well to talk about the way in which narrative can be important as pedagogy, obviously, and I'm sure we all do it. We all give movies and novels and things to our students. It can add genuine interest to what might otherwise be difficult and challenging concepts and theoretical ideas, and perhaps break down barriers and defenses which prevent learning. So it was in this context of what I see as an emerging narrative turn and a more acceptance of the narrative form as a way of teaching and researching and learning that I decided to write a novel. The second context, though, is the context of the mythography of terrorism and the role of the terrorism novel in it. Now, as a contemporary form of narrative, the terrorist novel, like the terrorist film or television show, is pretty much ubiquitous. One study by Applebaum and Packnadel has documented more than 1,000 novels which have terrorism as a major theme, many of them written since the 1970s, and of course, particularly after the 2001 terrorist attacks. What's surprising, though, in this context of kind of the rapidly expanding supply and demand for terrorist novels, is that literary depictions of terrorism and terrorists have not yet received the same critical attention from scholars as other terrorism-related cultural artifacts, such as film, television, and video games. And what's also interesting is that while there are one or two scholars who discern a kind of humanizing of the terrorist figure in this burgeoning literature, in fact, I think the more common view is that from the very earliest examples, the literary terrorist has been depicted in keeping with the dominant terrorist mythography in largely derogatory, dehumanizing, and demonizing terms. That is to say, on those few occasions when the literary terrorist is given a prominent place in the central narrative, most terrorism novels, because most terrorism novels are in fact organized around the experience of the victims rather than the perpetrators of violence, and in many ways the terrorist appears as a kind of spectral presence, anonymous and unidentifiable, if there at all. But when they are depicted, they're most often narrated as caricatures or stereotypical human monsters, I think, rather than understandable, rational human beings. More specifically, the research that's been done, as well as my own reading of terrorism in literature, the literary terrorist is commonly portrayed as suffering from philosophical and psychological derangement, either as a result of the disintegration of the self or narcissistic rage. Alternatively, or sometimes additionally, they're portrayed as inherently cruel and uncaring, driven by vengeful bloodlust. In effect, and I quote, a sociopath, an effect-deficient serial killer working for the money with whom no humanism can negotiate. Related to this, another common depiction, particularly in post-9/11 popular and literary fiction, is of the terrorist as religiously fanatical and absolutist, in many cases as a result of often negative sexual transformative experiences and individual maladjustment or the loss of a father figure. Unsurprisingly, particularly in the post-9/11 era, where mythology is of suicide bombers and virgins in paradise circulate through Western culture, a large number of literary terrorists are depicted as sexually perverse, oversexed, sexually resentful, or simply sexually confused. This is particularly the case when the terrorist being portrayed is female, although this is obviously part of a much longer genealogy in which women engaged in political violence are depicted as sexual deviants. A final trope of the literary terrorist depicts them as ineffectual idealists or bunglers. And you can think of Doris Lessing's The Good Terrorist here, who become involved in terrorism by accident or as a result of naivety or mental weakness. Moreover, when terrorists are portrayed, all the motives for their actions are most frequently described in terms of greed, revenge, rage, will to power, authoritarianism, fanaticism, bigotry, sadism, bloodlust, sexual dysfunction, and other reductive psychological explanations. So I think as a direct consequence, the terrorist novel often functions ideologically to imply that the terrorist violence they represent is devoid of authentic political meaning. The terrorists do not have a good enough excuse for what they do. That is, pathologizing the motives of the terrorists functions performatively to pathologize and thus delegitimize the ideology which motivates them. Crucially, following this, the novels recruit us to the side of the victims, terrorizing us along with them, and in so doing, implicitly enlists us against the perpetrators, rendering illegitimate the terrorist political aims, often without stopping to say what they are. And that's a quote from Applebaum and Packnadel. So I think there's a discursive violence that occurs in the terrorist novel towards the literary terrorist. They're misrepresented, and there's a failure to acknowledge the real humanity of the terrorist figure. And I think this is both a cause and a consequence of a broader terrorism taboo in Western society. And people like Joseba Zuleika, the anthropologist, has spent a lot of time deconstructing the way in which the taboo functions and the way in which, in particular, we're not supposed to hear the voice of the terrorist directly. Whether that, and you can, you know, relates to the years when we were at war in Northern Ireland, where actors had to perform the voices of the terrorists, or whether it's today when, despite numerous videos and letters to America and what have you, we almost never heard directly the voice of Osama bin Laden or any of the al-Qaeda terrorists. It seems that there's a taboo on directly engaging. So I think in this context, it's not surprising that most novelists have little direct experience of terrorists or terrorism and lack the will to investigate thoroughly the relevant academic research, media and legal transcripts, and autobiographical archives produced by former militants and terrorists, which would reveal the terrorists' human qualities and motivations. In the present cultural context, terrorists are, by their very nature, untouchables, highly dangerous, polluting persons with whom contact is to be avoided at all costs. Confronted with the dilemma that the serious novelist shares with the ethnographer, as Zuleika points out, the need to empathize with one's subject in order to be true to their tale, the terrorism novelist is bound to conform to the dictates of the taboo and avoid at all costs talking to terrorists. As a direct consequence, terrorism in the novel is largely a re-narration of the mythography of terrorism that precedes it. A mythography in which terrorists are the new barbarians, the epitome of savagery for the Western psyche. In other words, lacking the courage, empathetic projection, inner travel, and rigorous research required of the novelist to provide their subjects with a plausible psychology and sociology, the literary terrorist is most often personified simply as psychopathic. So again, I think the critical point is that the terrorism novelist, in many ways, like the terrorism expert, which has also been analyzed in much of the critical literature, plays a key role in constructing and maintaining the terrorism mythography and taboo. So as Naeem Inayatullah bemoans about contemporary novels depicting the Taliban, for example, he says that today we still have nothing meaningful in terms of literature on terrorists. So it's in this context that I decided to write a terrorist novel. And I deliberately wrote it as a kind of resistance and as unashamedly transgressive of the terrorism taboo. Not only does it attempt to meaningfully represent the psychological, moral, and epistemic perspectives of terrorists, but it seeks to do so in ways in which does not reflexively belittle, parody, reject, or distort the convictions of the militant, or simply reproduce the stereotypes and caricatures of the current terrorism mythography. Rather, drawing on the real-world voices and perspectives of militants, which it must be noted are readily accessible to any serious researcher, it seeks to responsibly listen to, hear, and tell their tabooed stories. So in a sense then, I see my novel not as a typical terrorism novel at all. I see it as an anti-novel, a rebuke, or a counter-narrative, an agonistic encounter and an act of discursive resistance to the terrorists, novelists' co-production of the terrorism mythology. And I employ narrative, therefore, as a way of unsettling, disrupting, challenging, and confounding, that is, discursively resisting, the existing narratives and networks of meaning that constitute the present terrorism mythography, thereby generating the possibility, at least, of a new critical political engagement. So what do I mean by discursive resistance? I use the term here in a way that's directly linked to Scott's notion of symbolic resistance, rooted in an understanding of power, knowledge, structures, truth regimes, and hegemony. Discursive resistance aims at the cumulative production of structural changes in orders of discourse, the creation of a free space for new language, meanings, and visions of the future, and the articulation of new emancipatory discourses. As such, discursive resistance is expressed in the realm of language, text, symbolism, ideology, narrative, and culture. And it fits in, therefore, with the broader notion of cultural resistance, which can be understood as practices of disturbing or rewriting the shared set of symbols and meanings of the dominant culture through a wide array of modes and expression. More particularly, I do actually conceive of this, and I wrote this novel, as an act of literary resistance, or it's sometimes called textual resistance, which could be understood broadly as employing literature as a device of resistance by writing against the grain, as others have called it, particularly in terms of transgressing epistemic boundaries, violating taboos, giving voice to the voiceless, desubjugating hidden knowledges, subverting language, disturbing certitudes, and so on. Paulo de Medeiros uses the term resistance literature to describe literary texts that rise in indignation against abuses of power and expose the abject cruelties that are still as much a part of our daily lives as they were ages ago. In effect, I am working really hard in this novel to try and break the taboo. Now, there's a number of ways in which, and I'll just quickly run through them, in which I think Confessions of a Terrorist can be taken as literary resistance. At the most basic level, the format of the novel allows the terrorist other, in this case it's the professor, as he's called, a little bit of a nod to the secret agent there, to speak uninterrupted and at length, thereby immediately rupturing the imposed silence on the voice of the terrorist, which is one of the characteristics of the terrorism taboo. As with the play, Talking to Terrorists, which employs only actual spoken words by real-world terrorists, Confessions of a Terrorist similarly paraphrases and directly quotes the words of many real-world terrorists. In a sense, then, the reader violates the terrorism taboo in the very act of reading because they're figuratively talking to terrorists and hearing their voices in a form which remains relatively unmediated and uncensored. I've also worked really hard here to try and rehumanize the terrorist and drag them back from the realm of the inhuman evildoer animal other into the rational political social realm of the self. Excuse me a second. Now, this humanizing potential is particularly the case in Confessions of a Terrorist because I deliberately wrote the professor as an ordinary man with a history, a personality, intelligence, compassion, a family, an identity, agency, and a personal narrative of loss, suffering, awakening, questioning, decision, and action. In the context of a mythography in which we are really only permitted to identify with the terrorist victim or the counter-terrorist hero, such a rendering of the terrorist is transgressive of the identity barriers between them and us, citizen and terrorist, victim and perpetrator. Jacques Rancière calls this embracing the cause of the other, in which the primary meaning of the cause of the other is a refusal to identify with a certain self. So in the novel, the professor directly questions and challenges, arguably he ruptures, the contemporary ordering of the figures of alterity, in this case terrorist, that defines our political field, in large part by asking the key question of the novel, who is the real terrorist in this room? Ultimately, such a rupture of the self-other boundary is potentially transgressive of the injunction to avoid at all costs identifying with the tabooed terrorist other. At the same time, taking such a discursive rehabilitation of the terrorist enemy other to its logical conclusion, the novel can be viewed, in my estimation, as an agonistic encounter in which the subaltern can freely and without restriction, in constant provocation to those who would otherwise deny them a political voice, speak. This is inherent to both the format of the novel, in which two people question each other and engage in a deep and sustained dialogue over social, political, cultural, and economic inequities that have become embedded in various structures of domination, exclusion, and marginalization, as well as in the substance of the engagement between the two protagonists. Here I'm following Rosemary Shinko in conceiving of agonistic practices as, and I quote, a way to provide political spaces where the friend-enemy dichotomy can be overridden and reframed as an encounter between adversaries, and more importantly, as a particular type of resistant response characterized by the search for difficult truths where morality itself is at stake. The main aim of the agonistic encounter in this case lies in the unmasking of political violence in order to alter power relations, a task that the professor pursues with relentless fury in the strategic posture of standing one's ground. In addition, the novel is written in the spirit of agonism in the way it serves as a constant reminder of our own complicity in the perpetuation of structures of domination and moral hierarchy, and in the sensibility that it is not merely that I see the other's face, but that the other puts her face in my face and refuses to make way, refuses not to let me see, refuses to be complicit, compliant, or subservient. And this is the essential attitude of the professor as he confronts his interlocutor and demands to be heard, not just listened to. Related to this, and following Elizabeth Dauphiné again in trying to be an academic text written as a novel, in which research findings directly inform character development and narrative form, the novel functions as an act of literary resistance because it provides a means, I think, of desubjugating important knowledges within the terrorism studies field in particular, which have hitherto been suppressed. And it does this in part by disrupting the zoological gauge between the researcher and the rigorously contained object of her knowledge, but also by deliberately trying to occupy the silences and to tell the stories in which the dominant discourse suppresses, including those of idealistic militants and perhaps also state terrorists. So, for example, while the dominant discourse asserts that non-state terrorists pose an existential security threat, the novel narrates a story of state terrorism, violence and repression on a massive scale. While the dominant mythography paints terrorists as theological fanatics, the terrorist protagonist in the novel reveals himself, well, I won't tell you, as, there's a word there that would have given things away, but intelligent, knowledgeable, articulate, reasoned, compassionate, and ultimately ordinary. While the terrorist mythography asserts that acts of terrorism lack rational and political purpose, the novel clearly explains how the logic of terrorism closely resembles and indeed imitates the logic of war, counterterrorism, humanitarian intervention, and other forms of political violence. In other words, perhaps the primary reason I wrote Confessions of a Terrorist was as an act of discursive resistance to a dominant ideology that in particular subjugates the knowledge of why people would violently attack us, maintains a willful ignorance about the resistance provoked by unjust and coercive Western foreign policy, and frequently leads to policies being made and even wars being fought, not in response to real conflicts, but in reaction to the simulacra of conflict circulated in the media and academia by way of a mythography of terror. In effect, I wrote this novel as part exorcism, part antidote to the terrorism discourse, believing as I do that to violently taboo and demonize the terrorist other is not just ineffective, but fundamentally counterproductive and self-damaging, as well as constitutive of broader epistemic and material structures of domination and oppression. At another level, and here we talk about disciplinary boundaries, I wrote Confessions of a Terrorist as a deliberate means of transgressing boundaries between the legitimate truths of acceptable social scientific research and the truths contained in other narrative forms, such as the novel, the autoethnography, the poem, the photo essay, and so on. This is what Rancière calls indisciplinary thought, which is the kind of thought that breaks disciplines in order to deprivilege the distribution of disciplinary territories that control who is qualified to speak about what. From another perspective, the interface between philosophy and fiction, which results from the transgression of boundaries, particularly the research novel, can produce critical thinking by challenging canonical social scientific approaches to political theorizing. Obviously, as a means of challenging the dominance of embedded experts and power knowledge structures, such a deprivileging and interface is an essential part of the critical terrorism studies discursive resistance project. However, more broadly, I hope that my novel will be received as a contribution to the broader erosion of boundaries that critical approaches within IR contributed to over the last two decades, including the growing interest, as I've mentioned, in narrative and autoethnography. At the very least, I think that it ought to be acknowledged that the professional academic voice is strictly limited in its capacity to convey some realities, some forms of knowledge, and some voices. Among other reasons, this is because, and I quote Elizabeth Dauphiny here, as we read argumentative forms, we raise our defenses. We know we enter the engagement with fixed roles. The author will present a forceful argument that we readers will do our best to suspect, resist, and expose. So this kind of ritualistic engagement explains in part why academic research, despite an ever-growing mountain of publications, often fails to stick, either in the minds of the reader or the broader culture. The fact is that I've published numerous academic texts about terrorism that make the same points as I've raised in my novel. So why then did I need to write a novel? And how can we as academics make our research really stick? As Naeem Inayatullah answers, and I quote, not by repeating the argument, not even by making the argument more forceful, cleverer, more anticipatory of reader defenses, or more packed with evidence. How then? By changing the form. Change the form so readers feel, think, and experience the overlap fictively. In other words, narrative can allow us to hear or to feel and empathetically understand, to know, in ways that an academic text is often incapable of. Narrative is effective. It can produce emotional effects and achieve an amplitude in readers that more formal ways of thinking, speaking and writing often cannot. Additionally, from an analytical perspective, as Dauphiny explains it, narrative approaches allow us to think about the worlds we encounter differently. They allow us to encounter worlds we normally do not see. They give us different languages and different angles of vision. Importantly, I have to emphasize that such an admission is not an attack on academic research and writing, and nor does it imply the superiority of one form over another. Rather, it's an attempt to expand the possibilities for learning within our subject by the addition of new modes of research and writing. So, in conclusion, in this paper I've tried to tell you about the narrative turn and the context in which I wrote this novel and some of the reasons why I consider it to be an act of discursive resistance and the way in which I think it has genuine potential due to its effective as opposed to confrontational form to reach a greater audience and perhaps to stick a little more. As such, I hope that the paper makes a small contribution to ongoing discussions about the potential utility of the narrative form as a method for exploring important issues in politics and IR. In particular, I hope it bolsters existing arguments for the greater employment of narrative as an analytical mode and method, as pedagogy, and as a form of resistance by scholars in the field. I'm not suggesting that narrative ought to replace existing approaches and methodologies, nor am I suggesting that narrative is inherently or by definition transformative. And this is an important point. Both social science and narrative can be transformative or they can fail to transform. The outcome is highly contingent on factors such as form, skill, context, and most importantly, audience. That is, in every work of literary resistance, the author's act of resistance includes an invitation to the reader to also resist. But the reader has to symbolically accept this invitation for the work of art to become effective outside itself. From this perspective, and I quote Gabner and Wood here, aesthetics are not in themselves empowering, but they can become so if author and reader jointly make this decision. Regardless of such contingency and whether any particular work of art can ever be shown to have engendered practical political resistance in itself, there is real value nonetheless in the analytical, normative, consciousness-raising potential of aesthetic forms of literary resistance. As Roland Bleicher explains it, and I quote, "Aesthetics is neither good nor bad, progressive nor regressive. It works more like an amplifier. Aesthetics adds a different dimension to our understanding of the political and by consequence to the ethical discourses that are central to waging political debates. Since art is not the language of habit, since it searches for the new, the different, the neglected, it may even create an encouragement to reflect upon and rethink what has been taken for granted, to move beyond dogma and promote debate about issues that would otherwise remain silenced or marginalized. In the end, this is why I wrote Confessions of a Terrorist. If it makes even one of its readers think differently about the discourses of terrorism, causes them to rethink what they have taken for granted, and generates new understandings and debates about issues that would otherwise have remained silenced, then it will have fulfilled its potential as a work of literary resistance. Thank you.